The Planchet is a product of the American Numismatic Society. Become a member and support this podcast. Go to numismatics.org/membership. That is numismatics with an S .org/membership to see options and prices.
Three coins in a fountain, each one seeking happiness.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Planchet Podcast from the American Numismatic Society. My name is Andrew Reinhard. I'm the Director of Publications for the ANS. And with me today is special guest Mary Lannan. For those of you who don't know, Mary was appointed as a member of the Citizens Coinage Advisory Committee, the CCAC, in 2014, based on the recommendation of the House Minority Leader, and she served as chairperson of the CCAC from 2015 to 2018 and was reappointed to a second four-year term in 2018. She is a resident of New York City, used to be a producer for public television, and also has a lot of experience in the wine industry, having worked in California. And not only is she a wine expert, but she is also a coin expert and a numismatist par excellence. And one of her interests that we'll be talking about today is about women numismatists and coin collectors through history. So welcome, Mary.
Hello, Andrew. How are you?
Hi, I am peachy. Yeah, all things considered, we're currently in, month 27 of the COVID-19 coronavirus lockdown. So thank you very much for taking the time from your bunker to mine as we talk about numismatics.
More than happy to do so.
How did you get interested in women numismatists, and where's a good starting place if someone wants to look at the history of women coin collectors and women in numismatic history?
Boy, that's really, it's sort of all over the web. I am interested in the history of women in general, and it's always been a little harder for women to do things in some areas than for men. And I started by asking some people at the U.S. Mint, how many women were collectors? And as a government agency, the best number they could come up with was, well, they think it's about 80% men and 20% women. But in that 20%, they really can't calculate how many women go on their website and buy, let's say, an American Eagle coin and give it to another man. And when I asked another dealer how many women he thought were interested in ancient numismatics, he thought less than 2%. And I thought, boy, you know, there's really something to that. Who were these women and what made them so passionate about this? I think we all know people that kind of go overboard in one aspect of collecting. And I certainly put myself in that group. I'm just fascinated about why they thought it was interesting, what they did to create their collection or how they got started, and where that collection has gone. Because after all, money is meant to be passed on, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. So, you know, we're dealing with, this kind of portable wealth these portable antiquities. And with collecting, you know, I collect all kinds of things. I don't collect coins, but I collect other kinds of stuff, everything from comic books to video games to musical instruments. And maybe this is true of other collectors, and you can tell me if this is the case, that most collectors will collect more than one kind of thing. And so, you know, do we see this happening with male collectors over time, but also with women collectors too? And those who are collecting for numismatics, did they collect other things? And why would they include coins in those things that they were collecting?
Well, I think, you know, I'm very interested in the psychology of collecting, and maybe someday we'll have a little chat about that as well. I think that you've got people that women and men who get laser focused on one particular area. And then something catches their eye, and it's kind of like ripples in a pond. It broadens things out. And I have to say that when I've been researching these women and looking at what they've collected, whether I get an old coin catalog from a long ago sale, I can zoom in on something that they've got and think, wow, why did they get that? And then, you know, you sort of daydream about the occurrences of that coin entering their collection, what it meant to them. There are some things that just really aren't very pretty, as we would say, about the coin. But guess what? Maybe 150 years ago, that was the best example there ever was of that. And so therefore, it entered the collection. It became part of their interest. So by researching these women, it actually broadens the areas of interest that I've had in ancient coins.
With you're mentioning these kinds of grotty coins that are kind of the initial first grasps at different types as they're, you know, coming becoming known in the history of numismatics and of collecting. And you know, I'm wondering what other kinds of themes there were. I mean, maybe these individuals are collecting because you're focused on a particular time period, or you really like the ancient Greeks, and so you collect everything that's ancient Greek. And the things that survive are these metal discs over time. And I would think I'm coming to this from an archaeological perspective too, in that we have these artifacts that have their own biographies. So we have the collectors with their biographies, but the items themselves have their biographies and a history of ownership too. And so, I'm wondering if that was something that people were interested in, who owned this before I owned this?
That's really my interest. Who had it? A friend of mine says that all coins have pedigrees. We just don't know what some of them are yet. And so if I can trace a coin all the way back to, let's say, 1539, that was owned by a woman named Isabella d'Este, I find that absolutely fascinating. One of the things that we should sort of get out of the way first is that the women that we have heard of that have coin collections all have one thing in common.
What's that?
They were wealthy. You can't do this on a small budget. You can't do this unless you have free time. And essentially that means that you are in the upper echelons of society. You can budget parts of your life to devote yourself to art, whether it's painting or statues or history or rugs or, artists joining your salon. But you can't do that unless you have enough money to do that. So there may be more women out there that I don't know about, but I'm not likely to hear about them because their collections weren't prominent enough when they were auctioned off for people to know about. So I'm just trying to trace the threads kind of through this whole little skein and see where they lead me. And that's what's really interesting to me.
Let's start with where you are now here in 2020. Yeah, how do you go about tracing the thread back to, say, the 15th century? You mentioned Isabella d'Este, and she was active, or at least she was alive, from 1474 to 1539. And how do we get back those 500 or 600 years? Does it go through the auction catalogs? Do we have correspondence? How do we know?
Well, the interesting thing about Isabella d'Este is there's a wonderful book that's been written, which I think was just a redo of a PhD thesis. And it was Isabella d'Este and her husband, Francesco Gonzaga. And it was called Power Sharing at the Italian Renaissance Court. Now, I can't begin to say how little I know about the Italian Renaissance court, but I think that the general idea of Isabella d'Este was that she had these salons and she had these artists and she sort of frittered her time away at something like that. And her husband went out and sort of acted as an Italian mercenary, depending on the politics of the moment. And they don't really give her credit for actually being a very political person and assisting her husband in that. And the reason why I found this book interesting was the woman who wrote it went to the archives and went through 12,000 pieces of correspondence between Isabella and her husband about how to keep Mantua in that political moment the way that it should be. So she was really very bright. She just wasn't someone who was a dilettante in the arts.
You boggled my mind there with 12,000 pieces of correspondence.
Yeah.
I don't know that I have 12,000 emails, that I've sent and received from the American Numismatic Society. Maybe. But that's an awful lot to to get through, but you know, I can see putting together those pieces to create this history of knowledge and of collecting.
Well, a more specific answer to that for the D'Este coins would be that they didn't think anything was wrong about stamping the D'Este Gonzaga eagle on the coins in the collection. And so you can
they put their own mark.
Absolutely. And so if you had a silver coin, let's say a tetradram, there would be the D'Este eagle hammered on the obverse behind the head of the portrait in gold. When they got bronze coins or gold coins, they used silver for contrast. And so that's one way to follow them through coin catalogs, is to look for the eagle.
How big are the eagles?
Oh, they're really tiny. They would be, I'm thinking of an eagle on the size of a Seleucid tetradram that I've seen. And I'm guessing that it would be maybe a sixth in height compared with the diameter of the tetradram. Really very small, but really quite obvious.
Yeah, so you know, something shows up like that, you know, that's going to add value to the coin, and also more importantly, perhaps a marker of history, so
well,
that you can trace back.
Unique. You know, there were many, 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 many thousands of coins of Alexander Ballas, who was a in the Seleucid kingdom, but there's only one with the D'Este eagle marked on it. So therefore, that coin now becomes unique.
With Isabella, was she collecting anything else, or do we know what guided her when she was picking out what coins to purchase for the collection?
Well, I think what we have to think about is the entire court in Mantua. It was see and be seen, if you know what I mean. Tapestries, paintings, poetry. That was the mark of refinement. That was what you expected the leader of Mantua to be doing. And so I'm sure that she had people who came and brought her things to look at, and she decided yes or no about them. One of her great sorrows in life was that she really wanted Leonardo da Vinci to paint her, and he actually did sketch her, and I've seen the sketch, and she could never ever convince him to paint her. I think that was got away from her.
But we have the sketch. The sketch survived.
We do have the sketch.
And there's no chance that he would have painted it. It's just there in the sketchbook, and that's it.
That's it.
That's it. She's collecting in the Renaissance, and you know, one of the other things, you'd mentioned just a second ago that this kind of this being conspicuous about, you know, the arts that you possess and being able to put these on display. Would these also have been considered to be investment properties? So you're purchasing coins as investments, as well as to demonstrate how cultured you are.
I think it was mostly to demonstrate how cultured you were.
Okay.
You were certainly hoping that the wars and all the intrigue that was in the Italian Renaissance went in your favor. But I believe that her coins were sold after her death by another descendant, probably to pay for more intrigue and armies in the Italian Renaissance.
With Isabella, is she the first real woman numismatist of note?
I would say that she is. She's certainly one that most people have heard about. It is the oldest female numismatist that I could find. She was born in 1474 and she died in 1539. The rest of the women that I'd like to talk about this afternoon are more into the 19th and 20th centuries.
Well, who should we talk about next?
So the next woman that I think that I would like to talk about, that I find probably the most flamboyant of all, is a woman by the name of the Comtesse de Bahag. She lived from 1869 to 1939, and she was the daughter of a banker in Berlin, and she was wildly wealthy when she married. Her dowry consisted of 3.5 million gold French francs when she married her husband. And she married rather unsuccessfully. I think she probably stayed married for a couple of years. She didn't get divorced for many, many years. But she had a salon in the house that she lived in Paris, which interestingly enough is now the Romanian embassy. And she surrounded herself, much like Isabella d'Este did, with various artists, poets, playwrights, painters, etc., and so forth. And she had quite an interesting collection. And much like Isabella d'Este, we always have to think about what was available at the time. What would have been interesting? I'm thinking of a particular coin from Elis in Olympia. And it's got a rather majestic eagle's head on the front of it. The flam is split, so it's not very attractive from that point of view. And it's really very, very worn. But for her, maybe that was the closest she could get to the Olympics in ancient Greece. And so she bought it. It has since been in a number of famous collections. But that might have been the most intriguing coin from Olympia that she could find at that moment.
With collectors over time, you know, certainly the farther we get into the future, the more specimens become available, the more things come to market. I find it incredible that in the 19th century and earlier, that people are able to find their way to the coins or coins and metals are able to find their way, to the individual through, I'm guessing, various networks, maybe through social networks or through, the dealers talking to each other. They have clients who they know and they know what their interests are. And I'm guessing that's still true today.
I think it goes back to, what they always say, buy the book before you buy the coin. In this case, I'm looking at this little section of my bookcase that has a collection of catalogs from women's auctions, when their collections were auctioned off. And I think that you need to keep perusing those and looking at coins that they collected, and that will trigger a little aha moment in case something comes up at an auction and there is no provenance that you can recognize. Sadly, for a long time, dealers threw away old tickets. So you really never knew what you were looking at. So by recognizing and familiarizing yourself with what these women had in their collections, I think you're more likely to find lost pedigrees that way.
And with the lost pedigrees, I'm thinking of these as being these kinds of eccentric pieces. And I'm wondering, if the personality of the collector, really manifests in what is being collected. So you'd mentioned earlier that the Comtesse herself was an eccentric individual. And so does the collection reflect that? Does the collection reflect that eccentricity, or was she collecting just really good examples of things that we would now consider to be kind of standard?
I think that the collection reflects a little bit of that eccentricity. I mean, after all, this is a woman who had a leopard-covered couch in her salon, and she would sit on it, welcoming people to the salon, wearing a green wig. So I think that she had a certain joie de vivre about everything in her life.
Yeah, I can imagine her having absinthe there in her Paris apartment. Ooh, as the green fairy.
Green fairy, exactly.
Yeah.
So there are other women, though, that I'm thinking of, maybe one that we should talk about next.
Okay.
Who are exceedingly disciplined in their collecting. And the woman that I'm thinking about is a woman by the name of Elizabeth Washburn King, who left her collection to Bryn Mawr College, which is where she graduated from in 1917. And she went back to school and got her master's degree in 1937. So she's a very mysterious woman. I need to find out more about her. I'm originally from Minnesota. And when I was trying to research Elizabeth Washburn King, something popped up on the internet where a number of women donated something to the Minneapolis Institute of Art. And the key was that every single woman had the name Washburn. So that I think it was the mother and at least three of her daughters. So then I began thinking about what was going on in Minneapolis and Minnesota at that time. And what I've been able to determine to the best of my ability without going into the archives somewhere is that she was the heiress to a milling fortune. I don't know if most of you know, but Minneapolis and St. Paul are divided by the Mississippi River. And at a certain point in the river, there were these incredible falls. Well, in the late 1800s, large flour mills were built there, harnessing the power of the river. And we think, yeah, well, big deal. Well, one of them put out 40,000 barrels of flour a day.
Wow.
So yeah, that's very remarkable. And so what her family, the Washburn family legacy, wound up actually being General Mills.
Oh my.
Okay. Oh my.
There you go.
If it all goes back to women who have money, that would be right there. So I'm guessing, and this is just a guess, is that she graduated from Bryn Mawr, got married, had children perhaps, and then when they were pretty much grown, 20 years later, went back to college and got a master's degree. And she was very, very interested in Greek art and archaeology, and she was smart enough to have Cornelius Vermeule advise her on her collecting. And the thing that I love best about her catalog, which was her entire collection was sold by Christie's in 1992. She spent a total of less than $31,000 over a decade to assemble the finest Greek coins matching archaic and classical art that she could. But her catalog lists the original owner of the coin. So it provides its own wonderful way to trace who had her coin before she did. And I'm looking at one right now. Here is a coin from a Croton. And this was purchased by Charles Morley in 1945 for a total of $44.
Wow.
So it's listed where she got them. Another one, here's a beautiful coin from a diadem from Segesta. She got it from Munson and Medallion in 1948 for $150. But good Lord, it came from the Jameson collection, F.S. Benson collection from Sotheby's in 1909, and from the Von Wontok collection from Sambon and Knessa in 1902, lot 490. How wonderful that is that she's preserved all of that for us.
That must be underpinned by her training with, you know, with Vermeule, and also, you know, being involved with Bryn Mawr and you know, their archaeological collections. You
exactly.
know, archaeologists are meticulous note keepers.
Yes, they are.
And so yeah, it makes sense to have that data come down to us, you know, to give that extra, you know, bit of something rather than just having, you know, an exquisite coin. And that's really frugal, you know, the fact that she's getting these things for, you know, pun intended, pennies on the dollar.
Exactly. Think about this.
Yeah.
Think about having enough extra cash over a decade that equals $31,000.
Yeah.
In the 1940s, that's a lot of money.
Bryn Mawr, I'm guessing, deaccessioned, you know, the coins over time.
They did. One of her classmates donated some Roman Republican coins. My area of interest is Greek coins. So I've never inquired further about the remaining coins in the collection, and I actually do not know why Bryn Mawr deaccessioned these, but it's a benefit for all of us.
With your research into Elizabeth Washburn King, what are next steps, you know, for you as you're kind of uncovering her history of collecting, but also her biography?
Well, I would think that it would be interesting to you know, go on Ancestry.com, for instance, or in the bowels of some archive somewhere. She had to have been part of the Washburn Crosby Company that eventually became General Mills.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't explain, nothing else really, to my mind, explains how she and her mother and sisters were able to donate very expensive pieces of art to the Minneapolis Institute of Art. Unless they had and obviously this is interesting. Think about this. Here's a whole family of women that want to make sure that their legacy is known by bringing art to the people of Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Yes.
So she came from a family that was very into art and also in a way public service.
Right, as one would hope.
So she was difficult to research because I can't even, right now I'm still looking for the dates of her birth and death, but we know that she collected from the 1940s to the 1950s with Cornelis Vermeule's help.
We'll be right back after a word from the ANS.
The Planchet is a product of the American Numismatic Society. The best way to support this podcast is join as a member. Since 1858, we have cultivated a community of scholars, artists, collectors, and amateur enthusiasts interested in numismatics and the tangible history these objects describe. Go to numismatics.org/membership. That is numismatics with an S .org/membership to see options and prices.
Another woman who has proved rather elusive is a woman by the name of Olga Knopke. And you see her coins come up occasionally in auctions. And she was a very, very interesting woman for her time. She was born in 1917, and she died in 1991. And she lived in Newton or Newtown, Connecticut. And initially, she wanted to study art, but didn't really have, as much as she loved it, didn't have the skills to make a living at it. So she did kind of a complete 180 and got into the sciences and became a chemist. Now think about this. So here's a woman who never got married. Mm-hmm. The records of her on the internet they're barely there. But she became a chemist. She founded a chemical company in Brooklyn, New York, called Argus Chemicals, with two other men. And in the 50s and 60s, she had patents for polyvinyl chloride. Look at every piece of plastic pipe you've ever seen, and that's got Olga Knopke written on it. And this is, I was looking at the patent offices, and you know, these are all things that very few people who listen to this broadcast will understand. But the kinds of work that she did, she had at least a dozen patents at a time when less than 4% of all patents in the United States were done by women. So here she has a chemical company with patents on something that literally every one of us uses somehow, somewhere. And what she did was she used that to buy both artwork and to buy coins. And that was sort of one foot in one world, which is the art world, and the other foot is in the other world, which is the scientific world. And she has endowed a scholarship at Columbia University. And I was able to find out enough information about that scholarship that one of the last people who won it, a young woman, was interested in theater. So that was kind of her never letting go of her interest in the arts. And when she died in 1991, she left about $2 million worth of art, American art, to the local museum it's called the New Britain Museum of American Art. And this was the first museum in the United States devoted to strictly American art. And so that's an enormous gift to them. Not all of them are on display, but again, to have accumulated this through the results of the patents that she invented was pretty remarkable. And one of the quotes that I think a nephew did at her obituary or at her funeral service was, she did not need the women's movement to get where she got.
Do we know much what Olga was collecting as far as coins go? If she was collecting exclusively American art, was she collecting American coins, or was her collection all over the map?
Her collection was primarily ancient Greece. I'm looking at the catalog right now. It was called Coins of Ancient Greece, the collection of Olga H. Knopke of Newtown, Connecticut. And Glendinning's, in conjunction with Baldwin's, had this sale in December of 1986. So it was almost strictly Greek coins. Let me page to the end. I think she might have had just a handful of Roman coins. Yeah, she had a few things. She had some cherosene. Looks like she had Ptolemaic. But it was primarily Greek coins that she was interested in.
For the three women we've spoken about so far, I know we're going to do one more. They all seem to be very interested in collecting classical antiquities, or specifically coins, you know, from Greece and to some extent ancient Rome. You know, was this just kind of a byproduct of things that were going on, like, you know, the Grand Tour, or interesting?
I think it totally is associated with the Grand Tour. At the dates where some of these women, you know, like 1917, 1896, et cetera, and so forth, that's when the truly wealthy went and did their 3 months in Europe and did the Grand Tour. That's when, you know, Greek art influenced Roman art. You were considered very sophisticated if you knew about those things. So, but really, face it, I mean, Greek coins are beautiful.
Yes. Yes, they are.
They are.
So who's the fourth person we're going to talk about today?
Well, I think what we can do is we can talk, it might be the fifth person.
Yes.
Emery May Norweb, who was a woman that had an absolutely remarkable collection of coins and medals and tokens. And she was born in Cleveland, Ohio in 1896, and she died in 1984. And she came from a very wealthy background. I think her grandfather started the Cleveland Plain Dealer newspaper. And when she married Mr. Norweb. Her maiden name was Holden. When she married Mr. Norweb, she became an ambassador's wife. And she lived in Cuba and wherever her husband was posted. When she went back to Cleveland, she was president of the Cleveland Museum of Art, and she was the first woman to ever have been president of that museum. She loved collecting tokens. She collected early Americana. She got started in her collection when her grandfather gave her an American coin. And it grew so enormously that she gave the Brasher doubloon that the ANS has is a gift from her. And the Smithsonian has multiple gifts from the Norweb collection. It was just incredible. We all, I think, have used at some point or are aware of a series of publications, the Sologes, that are published about famous coin collections. Well, the ones for the British Isle, 9 complete volumes are just of her collection of tokens from the British Isles.
9 volumes of tokens?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So the other thing that she had a really interesting sense of humor. The thing that's most interesting, or as interesting to me as the token, for instance, is the envelope that it came from. It was a pun on her name. And it was the outline of a spider web with a spider. And on the back of the spider was the word Nor, N-O-R, as in Nor web, and the spider was facing north.
Nice.
Nice. I know. I know. It's so much fun.
Oh my gosh.
So she collected American coins, she collected English coins, she collected tokens. She was just a remarkable woman.
You know, we have these 5 remarkable individuals, you know, coming through from the 15th century, you know, into the 20th century. And, you know, now we're in the 21st. So I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about the state of the discipline when it comes to women numismatists and women collectors. Do we see a greater percentage of women collectors and women numismatists now than we did in the past? And, you know, do we see more women publishing academic work on you know, the coins that interest them?
Well, there's no question that women have always been in academia. That's and they're very significant there. In terms of collecting in the distant past, when we were all going to coin shows, I still don't see enough women. Not as many as I would like to see. Some are coming with their husbands and children, and they're looking, but I see not as many as I would like sitting down and saying, oh, show me your Roman Republican, or, you know, show me the coins of Corinth, or something like that. There still is a fairly small percentage. Although, because I'm really interested in women in numismatics, I tend to talk about it at the drop of a hat to any coin club that will have me. And I have to say that the Red Rose Coin Club in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, invited me a couple of years ago. And I was thrilled to see that 50% of the audience were women. They wanted to hear what I had to say about other women. So I think that it's sort of incumbent on coin clubs to go out and to get new members. And they shouldn't just get their buddies. They should ask other women. I think that if we could get children interested in school, you know, there's always that the urge to get the next generation of collectors starting. Wouldn't it be great to hold up the coin of a woman and say, who is she? Who do you think she was? Who do you think she was married to? How many husbands do you think she had? How do you think she died? And get people involved in stories like that. It makes any TV show or soap opera pale by comparison for the lives that these women led. The ones that we hear about were incredibly successful, and probably more successful to the men that they were married to.
This reminds me of one of our Planchet episodes earlier this season. We're talking about the coinage of Mark Antony and the coinage of Cleopatra. And yes. There we go.
Well, I need to tell you, Cleopatra VII is my idol. She was the wealthiest woman in the world, and she was worshipped as a goddess. I mean, how can you go wrong? Well,
you can't.
But still, I mean, that's absolutely remarkable. I was just in another coin club meeting last night, and we were supposed to be talking about coins that began with the letter A. So I talked about Queen Amastris of Paphlagonia. And for those of you, to save them from running to a map, I will tell you that Paphlagonia was an ancient kingdom that was on the southern part of the Black Sea. And people in ancient times did not get married out of love. That was really extraordinary if you happened to love your husband. You got married as a sort of lesser individual to cement political alliances. And so here Queen Amastris managed to be married to three separate men. And her very last husband was Lysimachus, who was one of the Diadochi that was fighting over the remnants of Alexander the Great's kingdom. And with his permission, it has to be that way, he couldn't have divorced her and allowed her to do this. She left Thrace and went back to Paphlagonia, where she grouped four cities together and named them after herself, Amastris. And she probably for between 5 and 10 years, she issued her own coinage. And she was the first living woman to ever put her own image on coins. And her ungrateful sons from her second marriage didn't like it very much. And so they managed to drown her in 285 BC. But I mean, these are fascinating tales. And you can actually look at that coin online. You can go to a museum and see it. If you're lucky enough, you can hold one in your hand and think of the lives that she lived. Now, have we talked enough about these women, do you think?
I don't think we can ever talk enough about these women, and specifically, you know, women in numismatics over time. There's, as you've demonstrated, there's plenty more to research, plenty more to discover. Wonderful women, wonderful collections. And I've got to thank you for your time and for your interest into bringing this to my attention and to the attention of the listeners today. This is a great step in the right direction, I think.
Well, I hope to enlarge the information.
Yes, of course. Anything else that you want to mention? Anything that we haven't asked or spoken about today?
I think we're good, but if I got together with those five women, I'm sure we could come up with something.
That would be a hell of a party. All right. Well, thank you very much, Mary, for your time. And I look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks so much, Andrew.
Three coins in a fountain, each one seeking.